You're listening to Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. You don't have to go very far to find critics of Michigan schools, of the way children are learning, of what they're learning. There are countless statistics that try to measure the problems. For example, when it comes to education in the U.S., students are lagging behind their peers in other countries. When you look at standardized tests, American students rank 17th in reading, 23rd in science, 31st in math. That puts American students behind those in Poland and Slovenia. But what we want to explore here for the next few minutes is just how much pressure we should put on individual teachers to fix these problems. Cynthia recently spoke with three teachers who are all earning their PhDs in education at the University of Michigan: Natalie Davis, Alistair Bomfrey, and Martha Curran Price.
First, we welcome Natalie Davis. So tell us a little about yourself, Natalie. Where'd you go to school?
Well, I grew up in Detroit, so I attended public school in Detroit. After that, I moved on to New York, and so I did my undergrad at Columbia University. And I was trained to be a teacher there as well.
And what teaching have you done and where?
So I was trained to be a teacher in New York. So I did teaching in like non-traditional context. So I did some adult education things and some mentoring, tutoring things sort of outside of the formal classroom context. And then I did my student teaching in secondary chemistry at a school in the Bronx. And I also did some practicum work at a middle school also in the Bronx in New York. Then I moved from there to Chicago, and I was a third grade teacher on the south side of Chicago.
And here you are getting your doctorate now in education
yes,
at U of
ma'am.
M. And next, we welcome Alistair Bomfrey. Same questions for you. Where are you from? And tell us about the teaching you've done, Alistair.
Okay. So I grew up in Bay City, Michigan, and went to public school up there. And around 2000, I did the New York City Teaching Fellows, which is a kind of Teach for America-like mm-hmm. program. It's an alternative pathway.
Mm-hmm.
I was teaching up in Washington Heights in Manhattan, and at the same time getting my master's and going through a teacher preparation program at City College of New York.
What level did you teach?
I taught high school.
You were
high school English.
Okay.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And we have Martha Curran Price, and we get to ask you the same questions. Tell us where you're from and the teaching that you've done.
Well, I grew up in Philadelphia also. A product of the public school system, and went into teaching a little bit late in my mid-20s. I went through a traditional master's program, and mm-hmm. after that I taught in a Philadelphia charter school, which is publicly funded but not your traditional neighborhood public school, mm-hmm. and I was a 5th, 6th, and 7th grade language arts teacher.
Okay, so we have a broad array of experiences mm-hmm. here, and we brought the three of you together knowing you're clearly committed to teaching and to education, or you would not be going after these PhDs in education, and knowing that you have stood in front of classrooms around the country. And so we're looking for your thoughts on a central question, and that is this: can individual teachers truly make up for failings in our education system? And Natalie, I know you were a student in Detroit Public Schools. You taught in Chicago. So let me have you answer that question first.
Well, I think that to a certain extent we have to believe that. I think that that's true in any profession, that individuals definitely have an immense amount of potential to be able to really make strides within their own domain. I teach a course for pre-service teachers now, and essentially, like, that's the ongoing thread, like, within the course, is that despite sort of these systemic inequities, despite sort of this history and these seemingly intractable problems within education, that you have to believe that the things that you do in the classroom do matter, mm-hmm. and they do matter for those students, they'll matter for their lives, their own educational trajectories, they'll matter for their communities, and so that's not something to take lightly, I don't think.
That's a good point. What about you, Alistair? What do you think?
I think similar to Natalie, I think, yeah. I mean, it's individual teachers who are, you know, on the ground in American classrooms working with kids. And so, yeah, we have to think that they can make a huge difference. But I think another question is how do we put in a systemic support system to help those teachers do a really good job, and especially to help them when they're new. When they're really new to this hard work.
Mm-hmm. Hard work. And when we see the dropout rate in the first few years, and you look at that, Martha Curran Price, does that make you worried about the long haul for you, or are you just fired up and ready to go out and do it?
I think that's part of it. I think, though, that something important to remember is that teaching is really hard work the same way every profession requires really hard work. So the same way that doctors in medical school need to learn a set of skills and practices and do those things well, so do teachers. And so the burden should be, of course, on teachers to learn those things, but it should also be on us institutionally to really define those things for teachers that they need to be able to do in classrooms, and then to do a great job teaching them how to do it.
When you see this research that finds – I saw the one statistic that nearly 50% of new teachers leave within 5 years. So how do you think that we can create a sustainable model where teachers stay teaching and they don't throw in the towel? And I know, Alistair, you kind of touched on that about the kind of systemic changes. What do you think needs to change?
Well, I mean, I just to touch on this save the world mentality.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot of alternative programs are capitalizing on the fact that a lot of young people want to come out of college and do just that, whether it's, you know, do AmeriCorps or Peace Corps or something like Teach for America. I think that's how – that's part of Teach for America's recruiting strategy.
Yeah.
But I don't think – you know, I don't think that that mentality is going to be enough to get – somebody through those first difficult years. And I even have questions about, you know, like what is the source of that I want to save the world kind of mentality. But anyway, I think that new teachers, when they're there in the classroom, they need a support system, whether that's in the form of some curriculum guides or a mentor who's there on the ground in the classroom there to help the new teacher. I think that there needs to be support structures in place at the school. And I think oftentimes those structures are not there, especially in the schools that most need them.
What kind of structures should be there? Let's say if you could wave a wand, Natalie, and it's there, the support structures are there, the system works to help teachers. What would that look like?
We do a really poor job of having those social networks, like within schools, having strong relationships between the school, the teacher, and the community, and drawing from resources within communities. I think that we have too many kids in classrooms, and it becomes an almost impossible task to think that you can attend to all of their needs within sort of that given time period. I know that when I worked as a teacher in Chicago, for at least part of the time, I would have a teaching assistant. And it wasn't necessarily a consistent thing, but it made a huge difference at times, just for things like, I have to go to the restroom, or I have a concern that I need to deal with a kid or with their parent or with the administration, and just to know that I had someone who knew what we were doing in our classroom and knew that, okay, it's not – I can actually have my kids working on something productive if I'm distracted, because that's just what happens when you have 30 kids, 38-year-olds in a classroom. There's always something that could be a distraction. So I think that – having smaller class sizes for sure, having mentor teachers and people who actually come in your classroom and can give you constructive feedback and give you resources.
Based on years in the trenches.
I don't know if I'll call it the trenches, but definitely challenging work.
Yes.
And having someone else, a parent, a teaching assistant, someone who can really help, a co-teacher, someone who can help you manage the fact that you have 30-plus young people who all have different learning needs.
I'm speaking with Natalie Davis, Alistair Bomfrey, and Martha Curran Price. All have taught in classrooms around the country and all are now earning their PhDs in education at the University of Michigan. Martha, in your classroom experience, did you see where teachers would go above and beyond buying supplies out of their own pockets or buying necessities for the poorest students?
Well, yes. I'd say yes, I do see that. The school that I worked at, though, got better funding because it was a public charter school than my counterparts, for instance, who worked in district schools, which in Philadelphia, which tended to have less funding. At the same time, you know, there are things that are supplied by the school. Sometimes you have curriculum materials, you have papers, sometimes you don't. The issue is more that thinking about ways to support teachers needs to be done not on a district-by-district or a school-by-school basis, but on a broader basis. Do all of the schools have what they need to support kids and teachers? And whether or not then, the degree, the grain size that you're looking at, what that actually means, you know, might vary. But are we being consistent in terms of providing supports to students and to teachers statewide, nationally. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't just have to do with the kinds of supplies that teachers are having available in their classroom. Are we supporting teachers across states on a national level with the same specific knowledge base that they need mm-hmm. to teach?
And the answer to that right now would be
no.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I would just add that I think a lot of times the conversation becomes, how can we make sure that every school has the same resources, whether mm-hmm. that resource is, you know, like a, what are those called,
smart boards,
a smart board, a digital projector, you know, whether it's technology, computers. I think that becomes the question. Does every school have the same – are they equal in terms of how much technology they have? But I think the conversation should be, are teachers being trained how to use that technology in a way that's mm-hmm. going to be useful for their students?
Well, that gets back to this achievement gap that the country spends a lot of time talking about, and knowing that it is clear, just let's look in the state of Michigan and the variances between districts with what kind of resources are available. Mm-hmm. So is it naive? Is it disingenuous to expect amazing, energetic teachers to, let's say, save inner city classrooms and close that achievement gap?
Yeah, so I think, well, the first thing is this, the achievement gap, like mm-hmm. that terminology is troublesome to me. Mm-hmm. It's used very widely, so it's very common. But there's been a lot of new research, literature, scholars have been trying to shift the focus and reframe the issue by talking about education debts, by talking about opportunity gaps. And so when you think about an achievement gap, that's looking more at what it is that students' capacity to be able to accomplish some type of academic task, to perform well on a standardized test. But when you look at the opportunity gap now, it's not so much about that outcome, but it's about whether or not students have had an equitable access to opportunities that would even allow them to be able to perform well on tests. And so that's really where the gap is that if you look in the difference between a classroom where students are high performing and you look at a classroom where students are perhaps not performing up to the standard or not performing as high, that you see a huge disconnect between the types of opportunities that they get in the classroom, mm-hmm. their access to curriculum, the experience level of their teachers, so that they're not even having opportunities to learn this content that would allow them to perform. And so that's the first piece.
How do we best hold our teachers accountable? What do you think, Alistair?
Right. As a teacher, I want to know my students' test scores. Mm-hmm. I think that's really helpful for me, especially if those test scores don't line up with my own feeling of how the year went. Maybe I think the year went great, and then I get these test scores back, and I find out that, maybe kids didn't learn quite as much as I thought they were learning. That's important. However, I do think that there's just, in terms of these numbers, this data, mm-hmm. there's so much noise there. It's really hard to determine the correlation between the teaching and that mm-hmm. student's scores. It's really hard to make that direct correlation there. So to the point where I don't think it's really fair to make hiring decisions based on those kinds of
salary decisions.
Or salary decisions based on those kinds of scores. Yeah.
What do you think, Natalie?
I think I agree. I think that it's really very problematic when I think about this whole idea of these hero teachers or these really extraordinary teachers, and most certainly they do exist, and mm-hmm. there are even more committed teachers who are committed to trying to improve and work really hard. But to use the exceptions as evidence that all teachers have that capacity to be able to step into their classroom and then all of a sudden, they make miracles happen, that's a little bit unfair. And I think that it shifts the attention away from those support networks, from administration, from districts, from teacher preparation programs to be able to help teachers build that capacity and help them to continually improve. So I do think as a teacher in your classroom, you have an immense amount of responsibility and you do some things very well. And we all make mistakes as teachers. But at the same time, I think that in the absence of having support systems within schools, having continual teacher professional development mm-hmm. that's actually impactful and not
useful, seen
mm-hmm. as a waste, a waste of time mm-hmm. or just something to fill space, then I think that it's not fair to have it be such a punitive system where teachers are being punished and they're the only ones that are sort of the martyrs and thrown out of the classroom when there were no supports in place for them to even improve.
So let me just throw this kind of final question out to have you get your thoughts. Do we, and I'll say we meaning society, should we be, I guess for lack of a better way of putting it, lower expectations of teachers and place expectations and pressure on other parties as well? Would it be school district administrators? Would it be state legislators who control the purse strings?
Teacher preparation programs. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Go ahead. Where does the pressure need to be extended to?
Look, I do think we need to put a lot of pressure on teachers mm-hmm, because this definitely. Is a high-risk profession, mm-hmm. much like a lot of other professions. I'd say, though, that we need to be really thinking about how we're letting people enter into the profession. So my recommendation mm-hmm. would be a huge thing that we need to shift is our thinking about our licensure system. Right now, teachers can become teachers by taking pen and paper tests without ever actually being assessed on their capacity to teach. Mm-hmm. And if we create a much stricter entry, I'm not talking about entry into teacher preparation programs. We know very little about what qualities or dispositions make for a good mm-hmm. teacher. I'm talking about teachers who have learned to teach and are then being assessed on their ability to enter classrooms. That's one thing that I think really needs to shift. Once we've let teachers into the classrooms, that's not the teacher's fault that they were they were allowed to teach. That's mm-hmm. our licensure system. Those are the teacher preparation programs that need to shift.
What do you think, Alistair?
I would say, you know, improving the instructional capacity within schools. And so that means having people in schools who can help teachers be better teachers. Mm-hmm. And maybe that means having a principal who is prepared to be an instructional leader and not to just do the administrative side, which is also really important, but also is prepared to go into classrooms and help teachers become better teachers.
Like be a good coach.
Be a good coach, yep. And mm-hmm. and also have – and maybe have, you know, the veteran teachers in the building take on that kind of leadership as well. And also, you know, having – I think it is important to have some sort of common curriculum guide. I'm not saying necessarily like a strict curriculum mm-hmm. to talk about, to work around, but I think having something in common to – some standards, mm-hmm. having some common language helps people collaborate and talk about this thing that we're doing together.
So everybody's singing off the same page in the hymnal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well,
so look who gets
helpful.
The final word. We started with Natalie, and Natalie gets the last word.
No. So, I mean, I think everyone should feel pressure. I think teachers in classrooms, you should feel that sense of urgency. I think administrators should feel a sense of urgency. I think parents and families and community members, like, this is the future. And I think that we take it too lightly sometimes. You think about kindergarten classrooms and it's like, oh, they're just, you know, they're working on their letters, or in high school, or, oh, they're just learning how to write a 5-paragraph essay. But no, like, we are determining and through classrooms, through raising children, like what our world will look like. And I just think that everyone should be fearful and everyone should feel a sense of urgency around that.
Natalie Davis, Alistair Bumphrey, and Martha Curran Price all have taught in classrooms around the country, and they're all earning their PhDs in education at the University of Michigan. It really was a pleasure to talk with all of you. Thank you so very much.
Glad to do it.
Thanks for having us.